We have this very sort of romantic idea of growth. We think of it as this organic, flourishing thing.
Yeah, fluid, continuous.
Exactly. You plant a seed, it sprouts, a child, eats their vegetables, they get taller, it feels smooth.
But that's not what we're talking about today.
Not even close. Today, we are going to look at growth in a place where nothing is supposed to feel fluid. We're looking at cold, hard steel. And the really weird thing is, when you zoom in, and I mean way in, down to the atomic level, steel doesn't grow smoothly at all. It grows in these massive, sudden, jagged jumps.
It's less like a flower blooming and more like a staircase just appearing out of nowhere.
A staircase is the perfect way to put it. And for the longest time, this was a huge headache for scientists. They were seeing these cliffs inside the metal, and they had no idea why. They called them super ledges.
Which sounds like something from a video game, I know, but it's actually the key to understanding modern metallurgy.
So today, we're unpacking the mystery of the super ledge. We are doing a deep dive into a really important paper from 1982 by HKDH Padacia. The title is a bit of a mouthful.
It is, yeah. Diffusional transformations, a theory for the formation of superledges.
Right.
But don't let that title scare you. The paper is basically a detective story. It takes this phenomenon that looked like a mistake and anomaly and proves that it's actually a fundamental rule of physics.
So the mission today is to figure out why steel builds itself in giant cliffs instead of, gentle slopes. And to do that, we have to understand the battlefield.
It really is a battlefield. We're looking at what's called a phase transformation. So you have steel that is really, really hot. At that temperature, the iron atoms are arranged in a specific crystal structure. That's called austenite.
Okay, so that's the hot state.
Right. It's stable at high heat, but then you start to cool it down.
And just like water wants to turn to ice when it gets cold, this austenite wants to turn into something else.
Exactly. It wants to transform into ferrite. That's a different crystal structure. The atoms are just packed differently. So you have this new structure, the ferrite, trying to grow inside the old one, the austenite.
So you've got the parent, austenite, and the child, ferrite, and a boundary between them, an interface.
Right. Now, in the specific steels Padacia is looking at, this isn't some messy, chaotic border. It's what we call a singular interface.
Singular interface. That sounds very specific.
It is. It means the atoms are locked together in a very precise, low-energy orientation. Think of it like two Lego bricks clicked together perfectly.
Oh, okay.
They're comfortable, they're stable, they're stubborn, they really don't want to move.
So if I'm an iron atom on that boundary, I'm happy. I'm locked in. I have zero motivation to shift or unclick myself to let the crystal grow.
Precisely. And that creates a huge problem. The standard theory says if you want a crystal to grow, you just push the whole boundary forward. We call that continuous growth.
Like a bulldozer pushing a wall of dirt.
Exactly. But you can't bulldoze these atoms. They're clicked in way too tight. The energy required is just astronomical.
So nature has to find a workaround.
It has to cheat. It uses a step mechanism. So imagine you have a perfectly flat floor. You can't just lift the whole floor up at once, right?
Right.
But you can lay down a single tile on top of it, and then another tile next to that one, and another.
You're building a new layer.
Yes. And the actual growth is just the edge of that new layer moving sideways across the floor. The floor gets higher, sure, but the motion itself is sideways.
Okay, I can visualize that.
Yeah.
So the ledge is the edge of that new layer of atoms that's sliding across the surface.
Correct. Now, here's where things get strange. If we were talking about atoms, how tall would you expect one of those steps to be?
Well, if we're building it atom by atom, I'd say one atom high, maybe two.
That's exactly what standard theory predicted, monomolecular steps. Tiny, invisible little ridges.
Makes perfect sense.
But when researchers, people like Edmonds and Honeycomb, whose data Padacia uses, put these steels under an electron microscope, that is not what they saw.
What did they see?
Monsters. They saw ledges that weren't one atom high. They were hundreds of atoms high.
Whoa! So instead of a single Lego brick, it's like a 10-story building sliding across the floor.
Exactly. Giant cliffs, super ledges. And this was the mystery. Why on earth would nature spend all that energy building a massive cliff face when a tiny little step should work just fine? It seems so inefficient.
And nature is usually lazy, right? It always takes the path of least resistance.
That's the intuition. But Padacia's paper just flips that whole idea on its head. He argues that nature is being lazy. The tiny step, that's actually the hard path.
It's not the easy path.
No. In this specific environment, a tiny step is actually impossible.
Impossible. Like physically cannot exist.
Energetically impossible, yeah. And to understand why, we have to talk about the solute barrier. or as I like to think of it, the atomic traffic jam.
Okay, let's unpack this traffic jam. We're not just dealing with pure iron here.
No, this is steel. So there's carbon dissolved in the iron. We call that the salute. Now, here's the problem. The old structure, austenite, it loves carbon. It can hold a lot of it.
Okay.
But the new structure, ferrite, it hates carbon. It has very, very low solubility for it.
So as the ferrite grows, it has to kick the carbon out?
It has to eject it. It shoves the carbon into the austenite that's just ahead of the interface.
I've got a visual. It's like a snowplow. The ferrite is the plow moving forward, and it's pushing this big pile of carbon snow in front of it.
That is a perfect analogy. Now let's apply that snowplow to our tiny single atom step. It's trying to slide forward.
Okay, the little baby snowplow starts to move.
But look at the geometry. Fidaccia points to a figure in the paper for this. The back of this little ledge forms a sharp corner. It's called a reentrant corner.
Like a little nook.
Exactly, a 90-degree nook. As that tiny step tries to move, it pushes carbon out. But because it's tucked into this corner, there's basically nowhere for the carbon to go.
Oh, I see. The geometry traps it.
It's a bottleneck. The volume of austenite available to soak up that carbon is tiny. So the concentration of carbon just spikes instantly right at the tip of that new ledge.
So the snow piles up so high, so fast that the plow gets stuck.
It chokes. That high concentration of carbon creates a massive chemical force that pushes back against the growth. It's a chemical wall, the tiny ledge. It just suffocates. It stalls and then dissolves. It dies.
So the small ledges we thought should exist, they don't because they get strangled by their own exhaust fumes.
That's a dramatic but a very, very accurate way to put it.
This is the aha moment for me. We see these giant super ledges not because nature prefers big structures, but because the small ones were all murdered in the cradle.
It's a survival filter. And this brings us to the core of Fidaccia's theory, nucleation. You realize there have to be a critical height.
And the paper gives this a variable, right?
Yeah.
A dollar or Haystar.
Right. Dollars, dollars. This is the calculated threshold. Fidaccia worked out an equation that balances this tug of war. On one side, you have the benefit. The steel wants to transform. It releases energy by becoming ferrite. That's the driving force.
And on the other side?
The cost. The cost of creating the surface of the ledge, and crucially, the cost of fighting your way through that carbon traffic jam.
So how does being bigger help? If I'm a bigger snowplow, don't I just push more snow?
You do, but the geometry changes everything. This is the key insight. As the ledge gets taller, the ratio of its surface area to its volume shifts. It becomes easier for that carbon to diffuse away from the corner.
Wait, really? How?
The bottleneck isn't as tight relative to the force of the plow. The traffic jam effect gets diluted.
So if you're tall enough, if you're taller than the dollar, this critical height, you have enough muscle to just punch right through that carbon barrier.
You can break the deadlock, yes.
It's like those signs at the amusement park. You must be this tall to ride. But here it's, you must be this tall to even exist.
That is basically the physics of it. Dollars is the minimum height for survival. Any random fluctuation of atoms that tries to create a ledge smaller than that, it just fades away. It can't sustain itself.
So this is a beautiful theory. It explains the whole mechanism logically. It answers the why. But science isn't just about nice stories. It has to be about proof. How did Fidaccia prove this?
He went to the data. This is the third section of the paper. He took experimental data from other metallurgists, people who had spent years looking at these steels and actually measuring the ledges they saw.
He didn't do the experiments himself.
No, which is actually a great way to test a theory. He used high-quality, independent data from researchers like Edmonds and Honeycomb.
Okay, so he's got the real-world numbers. Walk me through the comparison. What are we looking at in these graphs?
If you look at figure 3 in the paper, you see a graph. The x-axis is temperature, y-axis is ledge height. Fidaccia plotted two things. The solid line is his theory, the calculated value of dollars, the minimum possible height.
And the other line, the dashed one.
The dashed line is the real data, the actual observed ledges from the experiments.
Okay, so here's $1 million question. If the theory works, where should that real data be?
Above the line.
Because his theory calculates the floor.
Exactly. Dora dollars is the absolute minimum required to survive. So any real ledge has to be at least that tall, probably taller. If he found real ledges that were smaller than his calculation, the whole theory would be broken.
Oh, what did he find?
The floor held. In almost every single case, the observed ledges are taller than the theoretical minimum dollars.
So that's a big win.
It is. Mm-hmm. But the bigger win is the shape of the curves. The trends match almost perfectly. As you change the temperature, the calculated minimum height changes the curves. And the real-world data follows that exact same curve. They just dance together across the graph.
I'm looking at the curve for Steel C in the notes, the one with vanadium. It's actually straighting. The prediction swoops down, and reality swoops down right alongside it.
It's like hearing a melody played in two different octaves. The reality is shifted higher, the ledges are larger, but the pattern, the tune, is identical.
But let's talk about that shift. Why is the reality always higher? Why isn't it sitting right on the line?
Well, again, dollars is just the minimum. You can stand on the floor or you can float above it. The theory doesn't say you have to be exactly that size. But there's another factor, too.
Which is?
The theory assumes a perfect world. It assumes the austenite and ferrite are lined up in this one specific idealized orientation.
The textbook definition of a singular interface.
Right. But real steel is messy. It has defects, stresses, the orientations might be off by a tiny fraction of a degree. But the fact that the trend holds this well, even with all that real-world messiness, is really impressive. It shows he captured the fundamental physics.
Okay, so we've established the floor. You have to be this tall to exist. But this raises the obvious next question for me. If big is good, why not bigger?
The upper limit.
Yeah. Is there a ceiling? Why don't we see ledges that are a mile high? Why don't they just grow until they consume the entire crystal?
That's a question of stability.
Yeah.
The paper does touch on this, and it's fascinating. Fadeshi admits that his nucleation theory, the math, for that dollars, it doesn't give you a hard number for a maximum. The equation doesn't say stop here.
So what does?
Structural integrity, basically. Think about what a ledge actually is. It's a step. It has a vertical cliff face.
Right.
If that cliff face gets too massive, say, a few times larger than an Allerger, it starts behaving like just an edge. It starts to act like a surface itself. It's a wall.
I think I see where this is going. If it's a wall,
yeah,
can new things start to grow on it?
Precisely. New, smaller ledges might start to nucleate on the face of the giant ledge.
Oh, that's wild. It's like this fractal. The cliff becomes a wall, and then new little steps start growing on that wall.
He calls it degeneration. If a ledge gets too massive, it becomes unstable and basically crumbles or degenerates into a stack of smaller ledges. It loses its singular identity.
So there's a Goldilocks zone. You have to be big enough to survive the carbon chokehold, but not so big that you fall apart under your own complexity.
Exactly. And that Goldilocks zone is the super ledge we see in the microscope. It's the sweet spot for survival.
It is genuinely fascinating how much drama is happening inside a piece of metal that looks completely static to us. You look at a steel girder and you just think, that's solid.
Mm-hmm.
But inside, at the atomic level, there is this constant negotiation happening. Energy, geometry, chemistry, they're all battling it out.
And that really is the big takeaway here. Why does this matter? Why should anyone outside of a metallurgy lab care about utter dollars?
Right. Beyond the cool physics, what's the application? Does this help us build better bridges or cars?
It absolutely does. It's all about control. We treat steel to make it stronger or tougher or harder. We heat it. We cool it down fast. We add alloys like vanadium. And all of that changes the final properties of the metal. But why? It changes the properties because it changes the microstructure. It changes how big or small these grains of ferrite are, how they fit together.
And Padishi's paper gives us the instruction manual for building that structure.
That's it, exactly. If we know the rules. If we know that adding vanadium changes the value of dollars, that it changes the minimum step size, then we can start to predict the final structure. We stop guessing.
It transforms metallurgy from this kind of alchemy, hey, let's throw a pinch of this in and see what happens, to actual engineering.
We can design the hurdles that the atoms have to jump over. We're setting the height of the bar to get the metal we want.
That is a really powerful idea, turning an anomaly into a tool.
That's the history of science, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that doesn't quite fit the theory usually ends up being the key to a much better theory.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one thought that stuck with me. We talked about how the math sets the floor, and how structural stability kind of sets the ceiling.
The bounds of existence, yeah.
But when you look at those graphs, nature seems to consistently pick a size that is comfortably above the minimum. It's not just scraping by.
No, it rarely skirts that edge.
It makes you wonder. The math defines what's possible, but there seems to be another layer of physics deciding what's probable. Nature seems to like having a safety margin.
That is a profound question. We've sort of solved the how, the mechanics of the superledge. But the why of that specific safety margin, why nature prefers that specific buffer above the minimum, That's a question for the next generation of papers.
And that's why we keep diving in. There's always another layer. I want to thank you for walking us through the atomic architecture of steel today. It's been a trip.
My pleasure. It was fun.
And to everyone listening, next time you see a bridge or a skyscraper or even the frame of your car, remember the giant cliffs and the carbon traffic jams happening inside every single beam. Keep looking closely. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.